Okay, Beatles fans. Professor Jason Brown is in the house. He's brought his guitar, too. You know, yeah, he's come with guitar in hand, and he's written Our Days Are Numbered. Not a downcast book, though. How mathematics orders our lives. Ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together and your guitar picks. Professor Jason Brown, welcome to the broadcast.
Hi, Andrew.
As a man who endured quadratic equations, I think in my last academic hurdle, moving into English and international relations, I really don't get math, never have. Mm. My brother was always the banker of Monopoly. I blame him. I blame him because there was always an extra 500 sitting around, right? So my numbers were always off, yeah. And you have a lovely abacus adorning the cover of your book. We've got copies of the book to give away. We played the Beatles off the top. Explain how music works. Why do we like some songs and hate other ones?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons why we like music, but I think a big part of it is the patterns that we hear in the music. And we hear these patterns whether we're mathematically inclined or we're not. And there are a variety of different kinds of patterns and transformations that you can do to the melody, to the riffs, to the chord structure. And our brain picks up on all of those. And it finds those patterns aesthetically pleasing. And sometimes the patterns are pleasing, and sometimes the expectations that the patterns set up and the breaking of those expectations are what we find particularly surprising and entertaining.
So when we are able to predict something, that creates pleasure.
Right.
And when we are, our brains have to refocus on something, where the refresh button on our brain computer is hit, we also like that as well.
Right, we do. And I think, you know, another aspect of it is that we tend to like, both in poetry and in music, some ambiguity. Usually in real life, you don't like ambiguity. You want to know where you stand. You want to know what people mean.
Mm-hmm.
But in music, if the song is ambiguous at a point, we'd want to listen to it again and again, and it has a freshness to it. So, for example, if you listen to the opening of I Want to Hold Your Hand, we have a natural assumption that that a song starts on beat one.
Okay, let's play I Want to Hold Your Hand. Do we have it? If we don't, we'll get it.
Oh, I can play your guitar if you
like. Okay, well, bring your guitar. We'll play. We'll play both. Huh?
I'll get a hold of it.
All right, thank you, Taylor. All right, here we go. Professor Brown, guitar in hand. Lay it on us, bro.
Okay, so this is the opening, and it's hard to find where beat one is. Is beat one where it starts? Well, the thing is that the song doesn't start on beat one. The Beatles did a transformation where they moved it back.
Oh, I want to hear this again.
Oh, we'll play it again?
Let's do this again. Okay, listen up, kids. Here we go.
Here we go.
This is the hip professor I never had at university. I was at the TAs do all the work and the other guys. Anyway, go ahead.
Here we go. Now, with that opening, you would think that it would start on beat one, but the Beatles were very clever, and they took the rhythm, and they moved it back 3/8 notes, which is a mathematical transformation, very simple one. But what happens is that when you listen to it, you can't figure out where beat one is. It's that ambiguity that makes you want to listen to it again.
Let's hear the recording. Taylor, hit us with it. Interesting.
And so when you listen to it again, you find out that it's a surprise. And it's a surprise every time because you can't really acclimatize yourself to where beat one is. And so it's just a very clever trick that they used in that song. And of course, that was the song that they broke America with. And it's a very clever song.
Now, in the human mind, the brain, like the man on the moon, we attempt to see patterns where patterns don't exist.
Right.
The issue of the sex symbol is drawn from the notion of mathematical symmetry. If you measure eye width, the distance between the nose and the upper lip and the bottom lip and the chin and the cheekbones, if you were to take 1,000 faces and mathematically average them, you would get a beautiful face, quote-unquote beautiful face. The Brad Pitt-Angelina Jolie thing is about that which is the most mathematically average. So sex symbol refers to the paradigm, the model of the individual in terms of our beauty aesthetic, which is mathematically driven. The same occurs in our perception orally with music.
Right.
We want to see symmetry, right?
You want to see some symmetry, but you want to have some surprise. And if you can always predict what's going to happen musically, you will find it won't be interesting after a while. So it has to be the right mix of that.
Why do we like jokes in threes?
Why do you like jokes in
threes?
That's
a mathematical proposition, too.
Right, it is. You know, I guess at two isn't quite a pattern yet. It's when the third one comes around that there's expectations set. And
right.
With expectations, you can play with them.
Yeah, and a plumber, a carpenter, and a minister walk into a bar, right?
Right.
Like it's always three.
Right, and two isn't enough.
No.
Because you have to set up.
Why do we want three?
I think three is, you know, with two, at a certain point you have to be able to distinguish where the pattern begins. And certainly with two items, it's not quite enough.
And how many times have we heard in filmdom, and of course going to the original source of this cultural reflex, the Bible, the Trinity. You've heard of trilogies. That comes from the Judeo-Christian Holy Trilogy, right? The Father,
right.
Son, and Holy Ghost. Again, threes.
Right. You know, I don't know precisely, you know, where in history three became important. I think it is interesting that they have done experiments where they've found that even relatively newborn babies, so that they may just be a few months old, can recognize certain numbers, and they can do some basic arithmetic, and they can recognize one, two, and three. Past three, they have trouble distinguishing between numbers. But it's very interesting how they do these experiments. They actually take puppets, and for instance, to see if a baby can tell 1 + 1 = 2, they put one puppet out on a stage, and then they hide it, and they have another puppet come along to go behind the stage, and then they show this, they lift up the curtain, and either there's two puppets there, which the child would assume would be the correct answer, 1 + 1 = 2, or they might trick them and put one puppet there. And then they see what kind of
stuff. I'm giving away copies of this book, Fascinating Man. I'm so pleased to have Professor Jason Brown here. 1-877-801-TALK, 405-6000. Stats, one of the things I had the most difficulty with when I studied psychology. You know, I thought Jung was a very great writer, and Freud, of course, very interesting, but stats drove me up the freaking wall. I'm pleased you're here to help figure it out for us. 1-877-801-TALK, 405-6000. Why is 1,000 in a poll considered a great sample size and mathematically accurate?
Well, when you're working with probability and statistics, if your sample size is too small, and often a guideline might be under 30, you can't trust the results. Because just by chance, if you're going to poll a question amongst people, if you take too few people, you might choose a sample that doesn't represent the whole population. So you need a large enough sample. And then you get into the mathematics of how large a sample do you need. And it depends on what kind of answer you're looking for. And sometimes over 30 will be enough, but sometimes that may not be accurate enough. And it all depends on what kind of error you're willing to accept. Because no matter how big a sample you take, you will never be 100% sure that your answer, that they represent the whole population. So that's why you take larger samples to be more sure.
Our days are numbered, how mathematics orders our lives. Okay, actuarial sciences. How are we able to determine how long someone's going to live?
Well, again, that's a lot of statistics they base that on. And the people who work in the actuarial sciences have certain statistical tools that they will use to make predictions. And for any one individual, they either get lucky or they don't. And I don't know if lucky is that you die early or you live long. But they have to take into account the statistics of the time that they're working in, and they constantly update them.
Let's go to a phone call. Patricia in Lower Sackville, what's your question for Professor Jason Brown?
Am I on now?
Yes, you are.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to say that I really like your program. I've called before, and I really like the show this morning because I found when I was younger, and a lot of people in my generation always had albums coming out and listening to new tunes off the albums, and we always said, you have to listen to it three times. And I always found jazz very difficult for my brain to assimilate, but blues, I could, you know, and anything like that, easy rock and roll, whatever. And the other thing was that why do bad things happen in threes? Very strange.
Well, it has to do with pattern recognition. If you look at Johnny Carson in his early days, former Tonight Show host, the real deal when it comes to late night talk, sadly, these stand-up comedians have never cut it as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, Carson wrote a thesis about this when he was at the University of Nebraska about how we like things in threes. And it goes back to our, and by the way, you've won a book, Patricia, so stay there, we'll get your number. It has to do with pattern recognition and our ability to balance the symmetry of two things with a third thing.
Mm-hmm.
It must have to do with comparisons and the capacity to contrast those two with a third thing. So
right.
The two set up a context for the third element.
Right, and one is not enough context.
Probably that's what it is. And four is too much to consider. For example, our memories. We can do seven numbers, but when we start going more than that, most people have a problem with that.
Right. So there are limitations, you know, and in all sorts of endeavors. I mean, if you want to balance something, you need at least three legs or three wheels for it to balance on its own. Two won't be enough. So these are questions about, in mathematics, about if you have a certain number of points and you want to determine a plane in three space, you need at least three points, and 3 points will define it.
Okay, I remember speaking to a senior person at Apple, actually the Steve Wozniak, the guy who, and I was at the airport getting him for an interview, and he was talking about his bags, and I said, should you leave this here for a second while you go to the phone? He said, yeah, it's fine. What if it's stolen? He said, too random. There, even in terms of statistical behavior.
Right.
What should we be afraid of and what shouldn't we be afraid of, Professor Brown?
Well, you know, I think small events that have small probability of happening are things that we shouldn't worry about doing as a one-off.
Like airplanes are safe.
Airplanes are safe, without a doubt. But, on the other hand, the question is how often do you take a risk? Even a small risk.
Even getting up in the morning is a risk, isn't it?
It is a risk. And it's a very safe risk. But at some point, you don't get up in the morning, right? So that's where the numbers catch up to you. But, you know, for instance, in the book I talk about, for you to have at least a 50% chance of dying in a plane crash, you'd have to travel at least 2.5 million miles. So, you know, for most people, it's going to be a risk that they're willing to take. And I talk about something called utility theory, that you have to balance off the risks with how you value things. It may be much less risk for you not to get into your car during the day and stay home day after day. That limits your risk. On the other hand, you value going out of the house a lot. So you have to balance things.
Lotteries.
Lotteries are...
And now, a friend of mine walked out of a store,
right,
Professor Brown, and a pigeon pooped on his shoulder. Big, huge poopy smear of pigeon poop.
Right.
And I said, Ron, what'd you do? He said, well, I had a meeting to go to, but instead I went out and bought a lottery ticket.
He figured he had his luck.
I said, that's good luck. I don't want that kind of good luck.
Maybe he felt it was going to get better.
Well, this is where you have a greater chance of dying on your way to buy the lottery ticket than you do winning, right?
Right.
So if you win, I would be looking over my shoulder.
Well, but that's something called the gambler's fallacy, that you think that good luck has to follow bad luck, and bad luck has to follow good luck. So if you toss a coin, say, 10 times in a row, and you get heads every time, you feel the next time has to be tails. And everybody feels this, I think. But as a mathematician, I know the coin doesn't remember that it came up heads 10 times in a row. The next toss is like you're starting brand new. It's still a 50-50 proposition. So this goes on in life regularly, that you have bad luck and you figure it's got to change on the next one. And it doesn't have to change. But we, you know, I was speaking to someone a while ago who remembered one particular year where he had a great year at the racetrack, won a lot of money. He thought it was an exceptional thing. He was very lucky that year. But the thing is, we tend to forget bad things. We tend to forget all the bad years where you've wasted your money, where maybe you've spent a ton of money on lotteries and won nothing. So if you win, a reasonable size prize, it's got to balance off against that. And, you know, I think that's just something that we have to come to grips with. And if you're going to play the lottery, as I do sometimes,
why would you, of all people, play the lottery?
Why would I play the lottery? Because it's not just the value of the money. It's the value of how much I like to think about winning and what winning would mean to me. And so there is an entertainment value to buying.
So as rational a citizen as you are.
Yes.
Jason Brown, fabulous math intellect at Dow.
Right.
In the math department at Dow.
I
can't think of anything more foreign to me right, as a humanities student than your department, which I greatly admire.
Right.
And yet you are out buying lottery tickets.
I do buy
lottery
tickets.
There is no hope for any of us then. We're going to take a break. Hector in Dartmouth, Carter, you have a question, and we've got some more books to give away too. Fascinating Man, How Math Orders Our Lives. Jason Brown is my special guest live in studio. And also, Love Your Wife, Get Better Sex. That is on the way too. We have it all here. We have to start off with the Beatles. Hang on, let's start again. Start again just for fun. Get rid of the cars. It's okay. Okay, we got to hit the early Beatles. We have to. There we are. Thank you. There we go. All right. Now, why the early Beatles? Well, Professor Jason Brown, only guitar playing prof I know. The rest of them are really square, you know, tweedy pipe smoking types. Now it's pot, but it used to be pipes. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Taylor. That's great. Now, why the Beatles?
Why the Beatles?
And why working out with treadmills?
Okay. Well, I think, you know, the Beatles are so well loved. I think it has to be the quality of their songwriting. But in particular, I find when I study their songs, there is so much inherent subconscious mathematics that went into the writing. And, you know, none of the Beatles ever would profess to know any mathematics, but it's there. And we pick up on that. And, you know, it's very interesting that George Harrison, in his autobiography, I Me Mine, he talks about that he didn't get mathematics when he was at school. Just didn't get it. And he said later on in life, he used to watch the Open University, which in England shows its lectures on TV. And he used to watch the math lectures. And he said he still couldn't get it. But the interesting thing is why is someone who doesn't get mathematics watching a math lecture on TV? It's rather incredible. I have enough time trying to keep you know, all the students in the class when I'm teaching them, and they're at the university. But I think it shows that somehow, at some level, he realized that there was something mathematical of interest to him. And it was throughout his playing.
Carter, welcome to Maritime Morning. How Mathematics Orders Our Lives is the book. Our days are numbered. Professor Jason Brown joins us. Go ahead, Carter. What's your question?
Morning. Professor, I've always had this theory. You know how people say when you're 10 years old, a year seems to be, you know, a huge chunk of your life, which it seems it would be. It's 10%. And then when you're 50, a year seems to go much quicker. So is that mathematically supported, that because a year is literally 1/50th of your life, as you age, the years really do seem to get shorter?
Well, I think that's a reasonable explanation. I think, you know, there's a psychological aspect to it. But, you know, so much of our brains is mathematical that would be the most likely explanation that it's what proportion of time that you experience now, how it relates to what time has passed. Indeed.
Okay. Well, thanks.
You've won a copy of the book, Carter.
Excellent.
Stay there. We'll put you on hold. Hector in Dartmouth, what's your question for Professor Jason Brown, the author of Our Days Are Numbered?
Yes. Hi. Good morning.
Hi.
I did have a question, and first of all, a comment on your Beatles idea. I think it explains why most other artists, once you listen to them a few times and they become predictable, so you lose interest in them, and that's why they have to fade away and bring something new to the table.
Right.
My question about numbers was, any idea who thought about 13 being unlucky and number 7 being a lucky number?
No, I'm not quite sure about that. You know, 7 may have something to do from
the Chinese hate 4.
They hate 4. It's very dependent on the culture. You know, 7 may have something to do with you know, biblical reasons, that 7 days in a week, and that was the day of the rest. 13, I'm not so sure about. It may have to do with some pagan aspects. You know, but every culture and every religion will have certain numbers that are favorites and in disfavor. I think the interesting thing is how numbers play a role in everything.
1-877-801-TALK, 405-6000. How numbers play a role in everything. Let's talk about the math of jazz music.
Well, jazz is a very intellectual form of music to me, and there's so much to know. There are scales that are involved, and when all the individual scales bring up mathematical questions in themselves. You know, when we're going to choose certain notes to form a scale, whether it's the major scale or the minor scale or a diminished scale or a whole tone scale, how do you choose those notes? And there's actually a music theorist got together with a mathematician, and he explained it as a problem where you have 12 seats around a circular table, and you've got a certain number of dinner guests. Say you have 7 dinner guests, and you want to evenly distribute those 7 dinner guests around the circular table. How do you do it? And under certain mathematical constraints, you find the only solution is the major scale.
Let's talk about Gödel, Escher, and Bach. Oh, we got a break in 30 seconds. We'll come back and we'll talk about the fugue. We'll talk about music and Bach. And we'll talk about something very simple. You're setting up your living room. It's all about geometry. And why do we love the way some things look? It's about math.
It is.
Coming back with more of Professor Jason Brown. 1-877-801-TALK, 405-6000. Maritime Morning continues right after the news and some commercial breaks. Don't go anywhere. This is Maritime Morning. He's from Dalhousie, one of the math department's rockin' finest. He brought his guitar here, too. James Brown is a professor of mathematics at the Department of Math and Stats at Dalhousie University, and he joins us live in studio. His book is Our Days Are Numbered, How Mathematics Orders Our Lives. It's all about math, right?
It's all about math. Yep.
That's why the Beatles were successful?
That's part of why the Beatles were so successful. Yep.
This email. Mike was on. A lot of people are emailing me saying, ask Professor Jason Brown. I'm saying, no, you ask him. 405-6000, 1-877-801-TALK. Well, I love emails. It is a call-in show, not an email show.
Right.
I will read Mike's email because he did call in, and thank you for that, Mike. Apologies for hanging up, but I'm at work. Stealing time listening to you. Thank you for that. We love it when the boss pays you to listen to me. I find this topic, Andrew, very interesting, and I want to ask the professor about his thoughts on some cause and effect theories, and if any research has been done in this regard. For example, the butterfly effect. A butterfly in Brazil flaps its wings, and a man is shot in New York. Let's talk about the butterfly effect.
Right. Well, the butterfly effect is based on a mathematical principle, a theory called chaos theory. And the basic idea is that it's not difficult to make a completely determined prediction over a short period. And the idea is that you've got something that's the previous moment depends on just the moment before. Now, that shouldn't be a problem for making a prediction, but what happens when it's several days later, several weeks later? It's the combination of not only all those completely determined little changes, but the little errors that creep into it. And in chaos theory, the result is, in the end, you cannot tell, even after a bunch of completely determined steps, if there's enough of those steps, whether the result that you get is the true answer, whether it's even close to the answer, or whether it's very far away. And so with the butterfly effect, small changes in one area of the world, they cascade, and they could have an effect somewhere very far away, but it will appear as if it's a random event.
Let's talk about the quandary of the prisoner's dilemma, can we?
Right.
And the issue of global warming?
Right. Well, the prisoner's dilemma is from an area of mathematics called game theory, which is a fascinating topic because it talks about how people strategize and how they make decisions. And so someone came up with this prisoner's dilemma. It was originally set in the setting of a two prisoners who might face some charges. But let's turn it around, and we'll talk about it in the case of global warming with two countries. So suppose, Andrew, you're country A,
uh-huh.
and I'm country B, and okay. we're trying to decide whether to cut emissions for to do something about global warming. Now, it's in both our interests to cut emissions over the long term. It might be a little bit of pain in the short term for people, for the economy, but in the long term, it's an advantage to do so. But if you suspect that I will cut emissions, it'll be in a huge advantage for you to not cut emissions because you will reap huge economic benefits.
In the short term.
In the short term.
Right.
Huge. And so I realized that as well. So what do we end up doing? We both realize that we should cut emissions, but we think the other one realized that as well. And so we're going to switch. And in the end, we both end up not cutting emissions and we end up with really the worst possible outcome. And we're sort of forced to do this simply by trying to strategize. So, you know, you could look at this and you say, well, it's hopeless. But it's not hopeless. Recognizing something that seems paradoxical explicitly allows you to look at ways to try to get around it and ways to try to fix the situation. Maybe you have to add large enough disincentives to not cutting emissions so that countries won't break a contract, for instance, to both cut emissions. So these are the kind of things that we need to concentrate on, and seeing the mathematics will allow you to focus on what the real issues are.
And because of the advent of computers, we're able to game things like never before, both with nuclear explosions, with tests. For example, there's a new generation of nuclear weapons that they're able to test mathematically as opposed to actually blowing them up underground or have atmospheric tests.
Right.
Our Days Are Numbered is the book, How Mathematics Orders Our Lives. Professor Jason Brown is a professor of mathematics in the Department of Math and Statistics at Dalhousie University. He joins me live. 7 degrees, or 6 degrees rather, of Kevin Bacon. 6 degrees of separation.
Right.
Let's talk about that number and that principle.
Right. Well, there was a psychologist named Stanley Milgram who decided to find out if he gave a bunch of subjects in the United States in a certain city the problem of getting a letter to someone else that they didn't know somewhere else in the States. And the only rule that they were given was you can send the letter on to someone who you think might know that person better. And it was just a random person. And they found out that, very surprisingly, the letters tended to get to people within 6 steps. Of course, the someone who got a letter would be given the same instructions. So thereby, the principle of 6 degrees of separation came about, which essentially says that for the entire social network of the world, for any two people, there's a chain of at most 6 steps that would connect one person to another.
It was 6 billion people. Is that mathematically correct?
Well, it seems impossible. But if you look at it, suppose that you know 300 people.
Uh-huh.
Now, each of those 300 people know, say, 300 people.
Right.
So right away, in 2 steps, you know potentially 90,000 people. And then you iterate this. And you find out within 5 or 6 steps, you're well into more people than exist in the world. Well into the billions. And so it's entirely possible. Now, there's some overcounting because, of course, some of your friends know each other. So there's a little bit of overcounting, but it tells you that it is indeed possible. And this social network is very important when it comes to things like looking at disease management, because often in these social networks...
How things spread.
It's an important topic these days. And you can find out that often in these social networks, you have what are called mathematically points of high degree. They would correspond to individuals who have an inordinate number of friends.
Our Days Are Numbered is the book, Jason Brown, the author, How Mathematics Orders Our Lives. The geometry of the house, when somebody is setting up a living room, let's say, and they want the one table over here, one lamp over there, it's all about geometry?
It's all about geometry. It's the geometry that you learned back in high school. And you can draw things out, and you should, rather than break your back moving things, you should actually draw a little plan and see how you want the room to be set up. And you can measure things, and you can measure how far things should be away from the wall. I recently repainted the interior of my house, and so I want to be able to estimate how much paint do you need. Are you going to end up buying buckets of paint that you never use? You can actually do a calculation. It's just area, and know how much paint you need.
I like to paint myself into a corner. Regular listeners know that to be true. Feng Shui, what's the math behind that? Is there?
I don't know if there's any math behind that. I think it's...
it's a Chinese art of ordering things in a home.
Right, and, I'm not sure that there is any mathematical basis for it. It may just be, something that's developed culturally, but I don't know of any mathematics behind it.
Monopoly. I love Monopoly. I tried to do a probability table of how many times you land on certain colored squares.
Right.
Now, I'm always a fan. Listen up, folks. The tan properties, St. James, no, not Tennessee, New York Avenue, and the other one, are the best properties. But, I've played the game where they don't get landed on that much. Can you figure out Monopoly with probability? What are the best properties to buy?
I haven't seen anything in particular. I don't think in the long run.
This is a world... important question.
Yeah.
Monopoly.
Be an interesting one to look at. I mean, because on one hand, you could look at it in terms of how many times you land on things. It shouldn't make a difference between, which three squares you take. I mean, there is some small changes that would depend on, where jail is, and you might end up in jail more often.
It's done in tens, right? The board.
Right. So,
Dalhousie has got to put all his resources towards figuring out Monopoly.
We need a government grant for this.
Do you think maybe I can get one?
Yeah.
What are the best properties to land on? What about in games? You say you recommend playing games with your kids.
Right. Well, I think strategizing is, a wonderful tool for anyone's mind. And so learning to play games and to figure out strategies on your own can be of huge benefits. And as well, the strategies that you learn to win at games is something that you can carry over into your real life. For instance, there's a game that you can play or a puzzle where you have two jugs that are of different sizes and you want to pour off a certain amount of water with them. And the best way to solve it is not to start with how the jugs are at the beginning of the puzzle, but work your way back from the end of the puzzle, where you want to end up. So in mathematics, I find often... I learn principles that I can carry over on into the principles would be if you have a problem that you can't solve, maybe what you should do is think of alternate ways of problem solving. Maybe start at the end and work backwards. Maybe look for patterns. Maybe trying to do some special cases. These are all kinds of things that you would do in mathematics that you can just take the principles. Even if you don't understand the mathematics behind individual examples, you can take the principles and use them in your life.
Do you play the guitar, Professor Brown, for your students?
I have played my guitar for my students. I take it in. I took it in even before I did my work on the Beatles. But I do take it in probably once a year for the students and play them some songs.
Last question, rock, paper, scissors.
Right.
Teach us how to win at that.
Well, the best you can do, if you're playing rationally, it's an example of a game where there is no pure strategy. That means doing one thing that will be best. What happens is there's what's called a mixed strategy, which is you do each strategy a certain proportion of the time. And the best thing to do is to play rock, paper, and scissors each a third of the time. And the most you can hope for is that you're going to win a third of the time. And that's the best.
Thank you very much for joining us. How Mathematics Orders Our Lives. The book is called Our Days Are Numbered. Professor Jason Brown is at Dalhousie. He is at the Math and Statistics Department there. And very pleased to have you. Got to have you back. Fascinating stuff. Great to have you.
Thank you, Andrew.
When I come back, the author of Love Your Wife, Get Better Sex. This is Maritime Morning.